This is Radio Utopia speaking. Thousands of years after living in communities, man dreams of a perfect world in which he will be freely realized and the community will function perfectly, without restrictions, misfortune, hunger, conflict. In these visions is incorporated the complex of human nature and its individual desires and needs, social reality and history, which determine whether these worlds are possible or remain in the realm of fantasy, and whether we can ever imagine living in a world like this. Each time carries its own characteristics and its own problems, as far as the functioning of the community and society is concerned. Hence the needs of to fantasize about a better and finally perfect society. That is why every time and every society gave its visions and ideas on how it should work successfully, avoiding and overcoming the problems of the current situation. But really, is such a world possible at all? And can it exist in reality? The world utopia in literature was introduced by Thomas More, taken from his novel Utopia, the first official utopia, written in 1516, to depict a fictional island society and its religious, social and political conditions. Utopia is practically the name of this fictional island located in the Atlantic Ocean and ruled by an ideal socio-political system. Utopia comes from the Greek O, meaning not, and topos, meaning place, but with a topographic suffix ea, meaning utopia, or Latinized utopia, which means not a place or place that does not exist, which indicates that more does not consider such an ideal place can really exist. In defining the origin of the word utopia, we could also take into account the Latinized form of utopia, from eu, good, instead of o, and again topos, place, which would mean a good place, and one of the most common interpretations is used is that it is a perfect place, a society, but which in the end is not existent and unachievable. Yet utopia means positive utopia or perfect, but not unreal and fictitious. Hence, the later meaning of the term utopia incorrectly implies a perfect place, not a place that does not exist, a non-place.
So the real definition of a perfect society, but one that really exists, is utopia.
The term, in addition to being used to describe these fictional societies described in the literature, is also used to describe ideal communities that seek to form an ideal society whose members live in perfect harmony. Karl Mannheim believes that changing the social order does not necessarily stem from the utopian fantasy. Utopia is not a pattern that could change the existing social order by inspiring the community or part of the community with a desire for change, even if their orientation leads to action that will partially or completely shake the existing order of things. Such an orientation, which is not in line with reality, he believes, becomes utopian only if it does not seek to sever ties with the existing order. Many authors also believe that a written utopia must be distinguished from a utopia in practice. Written utopia is always, or almost always, defined as such by the author himself, who has no illusions about the possibilities of applying the constitution, the advantages of which he lives. This is not the case with utopian practice, for which it is impossible to determine the criteria. This division prevents the mixing and putting together of various political movements and social groups that seek to change or improve society, because any association could be considered a utopia if the goal is the happiness of those who associate. Obviously, the word utopia achieves great success, hence the noun utopia, and is used pejoratively when we want to indicate something unreal, impractical, ideal, which is impossible to achieve, and also give the adjective utopian, which expresses the impossible character of desire and intention. Despite these connotations of the word utopia, it is still considered that the society that Moore describes in his work Utopia is not actually his vision of a perfect society, but through his presentation he wants to establish contrast between the unusual political ideas of the non-existent country and chaotic politics in his time, from where he took a position to criticize the current situation of the social condition in Europe.
As I heard it spoken, that indeed was a thing light and easy to be done. Howbeit, to the dispatching of this so little business, my other cares and troubles did leave almost less than no leisure. Whiles I do daily bestow my time about law matters, some to plead, some to hear, some as an arbitrator with mine award to determine, some as an umpire or a judge with my sentence finally to discuss. Whiles I go one way to see and visit my friend, another way about mine own private affairs. Whiles I spend almost all the day abroad amongst other, and the residue at home among mine own. I leave to myself, I mean to my book, no time. For when I am come home, I must common with my wife, chat with my children, and talk with my servants. All the which things I reckon and account among business, for as much as they must of necessity be done. And done must they needs be, unless a man will be a stranger in his own house. And in any wise, a man must so fashion and order his conditions, and so express himself.
On the contrary, they would look on the mitigation of the punishment as an invitation to commit more crime. I answered, "It seems to me a very unjust thing to take away a man's life for a little money, for nothing in the world can be of equal value with a man's life. And if it be said that it is not for the money that one suffers, but for his breaking the law, I must say, extreme justice is an extreme injury, for we ought not to approve of those terrible laws that make the smallest offenses capital, nor of that opinion of the Stoics that makes all crimes equal, as if there were no difference to be made between the killing of a man and the taking of his purse, between which, if we examine things impartially, there is no likeness nor proportion. God has commanded us not to kill, and shall we kill so easily for a little money? But if one shall say that by the law we are only forbid to kill any except when the laws of the land allow of it, and on the same grounds laws may be made in some cases to allow of adultery and perjury, for God having taken from us the right of disposing either of our own or of other people's lives, if it is pretended that the mutual consent of men in making laws can authorize manslaughter in cases in which God has given us no example, that it frees people from the obligation of the divine law, and so makes murder a lawful action, what is this but to give a preference to human laws before the divine? And if this is once admitted, by the same rule, men may, in all other things, put what restrictions they please upon the laws of God. If, by the Mosaical law, though it was rough and severe, as being a yoke laid on an obstinate and servile nation, men were only fined, and not put to death for theft, we cannot imagine that in this new law of mercy, in which God treats us with the tenderness of a father, he has given us a greater license to cruelty than he did to the Jews. Upon these reasons it is that I think
at a time when capitalism from the very beginnings shows its internal contradictions and creates enormous social contrast among the population, humanism revives the old ideas of the unity of the human race and the aspiration to create a common, universal human culture. The Church, on the other hand, advocates similar ideas, but still with a feudal character. That is why the humanists advocate a reform that will bring with it the idea of an independent nation state and church, and above all a church liberated from the Middle Ages. The current situation in England in the 15th century, the misery of the masses on the other hand, and the lavish life of the social elite on the other, and the still strong influence of the church seriously influenced the creation of Moore's Reformation ideas. His humanistic education certainly played a key role in shaping his thinking and directly influenced the utopian notions of imagining an ideal society, as well as specifically the work Utopia, putting him in the first lines of all utopian thinkers. In those almost harsh conditions, at the very beginning of capitalism, Moore's Utopia emerges as a critique of modern society, but which foretells a completely different society.
So they shut of their own accord, and there being no property among them, every man may freely enter into any house whatsoever. At every 10 years' end, they shift their houses by lots. They cultivate their gardens with great care, so that they have both vines, fruits, herbs, and flowers in them. And all is so well ordered and so finely kept that I never saw gardens anywhere that were both so fruitful and so beautiful as theirs. And this humor of ordering their gardens so well is not only kept up by the pleasure they find in it, but also by an emulation between the inhabitants of the several streets who vie with each other. And there is, indeed, nothing belonging to the whole town that is both more useful and more pleasant. So that he who founded the town seems to have taken care of nothing more than of their gardens, for they say the whole scheme of the town was designed at first by Eutropus, but he left all that belonged to the ornament and improvement of it to be added by those that should come after him, that being too much for one man to bring to perfection. Their records that contain the history of their town and state are preserved with an exact care and run backwards 1760 years. From these it appears that their houses were at first low and mean, like cottages made of any sort of timber,
and seldom chances with any stranger, unless he be guided by an Utopian, can come into this haven, insomuch as that they themselves could scarcely enter without jeopardy, but that their way is directed and ruled by certain landmarks standing on the shore. But turning, translating, and removing these marks into other places, they may destroy their enemies' navies, be they never so many. The outside or utter circuit of the land is also full of havens, but the landing is so surely fenced, what by nature and what by workmanship of man's hand, that a few defenders may drive back many armies. Howbeit, as they say, and as the fashion of the place itself doth partly show, it was not ever compassed about by the sea. But King Eutopus, whose name as conqueror the island beareth, for before his time it was called Abraxa, which also brought the rude and wild people to that excellent perfection in all good fashions, humanity and civil gentleness, wherein they now go beyond all the people of the world. Even at his first arriving and entering upon the land, forthwith obtaining the victory, caused 15 miles space of uplandish ground, where the sea had no passage, to be cut and digged up, and so brought the sea round about the land. He set to this work, not only the inhabitants.
Tommaso Campanella is another key thinker of utopian thought, and he bases his work, The City of the Sun, written in Italian 1602, which is one of the boldest, most complete and most beautiful utopias ever written, on very similar principles as Thomas More in terms of arranging the non-existent imaginary island state. The political and social circumstances of the 14th century Calabria, southern Italy, where Campanella was born, and the long Spanish yoke under which was at that time, only show the bad situation that prevailed not only in Italy, but in all of Europe. Hence his ideas and plans for the liberation of Italy, and he went so far as to reform the country, create new laws and new systems of governing society. Like many other heretics who supplemented their religious reform with social changes, he insisted that his political uprising be at the same time a social revolution. Undoubtedly, this situation, the resignation he had against the system and the long, complicated prison life he lived because of his open-mindedness, conceived in him the idea of the City of the Sun, Civitas Solis, which he would later write. So Campanella, fighting for the rebirth of the human spirit and against tyranny and sophistry, gives a very similar critique of the current social and spiritual misery of the Middle Ages, and by observing nature and experience, seeks to free the mind from philosophical, ontological dogma, and empty scholastic discussions.
The great ruler among them is a priest whom they call by the name Ho, though we should call him metaphysic. He is head over all in temporal and spiritual matters, and all business and lawsuits are settled by him as the supreme authority. Three princes of equal power, namely Pon, Sin, and More, assist him, and these in our tongue we should call Power, Wisdom, and Law. To Power belongs the care of all matters related to war and peace. He attends to the military arts, and next to Ho, He is ruler of every affair of a warlike nature. He governs the military magistrates and the soldiers, and has the management of the munitions, the fortifications, the storming of places, the implements of war, the armories, the smiths and workmen connected with matters of this sort. But wisdom is the ruler of the liberal arts, of mechanics, of all sciences with their magistrates and doctors, and of the discipline of the schools. As many doctors as there are under his control. There is one doctor who is called Astrologus, a second Cosmographus, a third Arithmeticus, a fourth Geometra, a fifth Historiographus, a sixth Poeta, a seventh Logicus, an eighth Rhetor, a ninth Grammaticus, a tenth Medicus, an 11th Physiologus, a 12th Politicus, a 13th Moralis. They have but one book, which they call Wisdom, and in it all the sciences are written with conciseness and marvelous fluency of expression. This they read to the people after the custom of the Pythagoreans. It is wisdom who causes the exterior and interior, the higher and lower walls of the city, to be adorned with the finest pictures, and to have all the sciences painted upon them in an admirable manner. On the walls of the temple and on the dome, which is let down when the priest gives an address, as the sounds of his voice being scattered should fly away from his audience, there are pictures of stars and their different magnitudes, with the powers and motions of each expressed separately in three little verses. On the interior wall of the first circuit, all the mathematical figures are conspicuously painted, figures more in number than Archimedes or Euclid discovered, marked symmetrically, and with the explanation of them neatly written and contained each in a little verse. There are definitions and propositions, and so on. On the exterior convex wall is first an immense drawing of the whole earth, given at one view. Following upon this, there are tablets setting forth for every separate country the customs, both public and private, the laws, the origins and the power of the inhabitants.
Utopiju smo postavili nasuprot svetu, ali upravo su naše utopije ono što svet čini podnošljivim. Gradovi i domovi o kojima ljudi sanjaju jesu oni kojima na kraju žive. Što više utiču na svoje okruženje i oblikuju ga po sobstvenom obrascu, ljudi sve istrajnije žive u utopiji. Ali kada se ukaže jaz između sveta činjenica, i utopijske onostranost, postajemo svesni udjela sklonosti ka utopiji u našim životima, a svoje utopije pokažemo kao odvojenu stvarnost. U ovoj knjizi istražit ćemo upravo tu posebnu stvarnost utopije. Utopije kao sveta za sebe, podeljeno kao idealna zajednica, sa svim svojim naseljima grupisanim oko ponositih gradova koji smelo teži dobrom životu. Oblik i boju raspravama o idealnim zajednicama daje vreme u kojima su pisani. Platonova država je nastala u periodu društvene dezintegracije posle Peloponovskog rata. Nešto od njene jetke smelosti verovatno potiče iz beznadežnosti uslova kojima je Platon bio svedok. Usred sličnog perioda pometnje i nasilja, i sir Thomas More je postavio temelje svoje idealne zajednice. Utopija je bila most koji je trebalo da savlada jaz između starog poretka srednjeg veka i novih interesa institucije renesanse. U izlaganju te istorije i kritike utopije, možda i nas goni isti onaj interes koji je Platon i Mora gurao napred. Naime, te kada Oluja prođe, usuđujemo se da pogledom potražimo dugu. Naš pat u ambis razočaranja podstakao nas je da još temeljnije razmotrimo krajnja dobra, osnovne namere, ceo koncept dobrog života koji smo bili vođeni u ovo naše moderno doba. Zato možda treba narušiti sve te mlake i apatične rasprave koje se vode oko zakona o prohibiciji i mirovnim konferencijama i zahtevati razgovor o suštinskim stvarima. Razmotrimo utopiju. Ali zašto je uopšte nužno pričati o utopijama i svetu ideja? Zašto se ne bismo zadovoljili svojim materijalnim okruženjem tako da nam misle ne blude po oblastima s one strane prostora i vremena? Ali, alternativa s kojom se suočavamo nije da li treba živjeti u stvarnom svetu ili sanjariti u utopiji. Naime, ljudska bića su tako konstruisana da samo stroga samodisciplina kakva se sreće kod hinduističkih asketa ili američkih biznismena može i svesti isključiti jedan ili drugi svet. Prava alternativa s kojom se većina nas suočava jest ona između besciljne eskapističke utopije i strahovite utopije rekonstrukcije. Čini se da, na ovaj ili onaj način, u ovom stvarnom svetu, prepunom frustracija, prosto moramo dobar deo svog mentalnog života provesti u utopiji. Ipak, potrebna su i dodatna preciziranja. Jasno je da neki tipovi ljudi nemaju potrebu za ličnim utopijama i da one izostaju u određenim zajednicama. Izgleda da su divljaci s Markijskih ostrava, koje je svojevremeno opisao Herman Melville, zaista srećno i potpuno prilagođeni svom okruženju, ako ne računamo povremene pohode neprijateljskih plemena, za što se pokazuje da je više neka vrsta sporta koji zadovoljava njihovu sklonost ka gozbama koje posle toga slede. Oni direktno raspolažu svime što je potrebno za dobar život na Južnim morima. Ne moraju da sanjare o nekom srećnijem životu, ostaje i samo da ga zgrabe. Ponekad možda u detinjstvu čini se da život odiše sličnom punošću i isto tako, nema nikakve sumnje da je mnogim zrelijim ljudima uspjeva da svoje ograničenja pretoče u prilično adekvatne odgovore na skučeno okruženje i da onda samo puštaju da sve ide kako ide. Takvi ljudi nemaju potrebu za utopiju, sve dok im uspjeva da ograniče svoj kontakt sa svetom. Samo neki upad s polja može stvoriti takvu potrebu. Takvi ljudi liče na bolesnike iz parabola jednog persijskog pesnika, čija je jedina želja bila da nešto stvarno želi. Na tome mu se sigurno ne može pozavidjeti. Ljudi koji nikada ne krenu na otvoreno more bivaju uskraćeni za iskustvo suočavanja s opasnošću širom otvorenih očiju. U najboljem slučaju znaju samo za polovinu onoga što čini život. Ono što bi takvi ljudi mogli nazvati dobrim životom jednostavno nije dovoljno dobro. Ne možemo se zadovoljiti samo delićem postojanja, ma koliko tome bili prilagođeni, kada u sasvim mali napor možemo napraviti pun krug. Ali bilo je nekoliko oblasti, nekoliko društvenih poredaka i nekolicina ljudi kod kojih prilagođavanje nije bilo potpuno, kada se suočava sa stalnim teškoćama i preprekama, vetrom i nepogodom, impulsima drugih ljudi i davno preživjelim običajima, čovjek, grubo govoreći, može da reaguje na tri načina. Može pobeći, može ostati na svome, može napasti. Kada pogledam svoje savremenike koji su preživjeli rat, prilično je jasno da se većina njih nalazi u prvom stadijumu panike i očaja. U zanimljivom članku Ishod nihilizma, Edward Townsend Booth je za generaciju rođenu krajem 80. godina 20. veka rekao da pate od potpuno paralize volje, odnosno da ako im je ostalo nešto od inicijative, onda emigriraju u Europu ili na ostrva Južnih mora ili se povlače u neki tihi kutak Sjedinjenih Država, ali većina nastavlja sa životom živih mrtvaca.
Thomas More in his Utopia presents a complex, independent city located on the island of Utopia. Named after the conqueror Utop, former name was Abraxa, and where the community has a common culture, way of life, customs. The city of Amaroth, the capital, is one of the 54 cities and is the same as all the other on the island. But still, More chooses this city because, as he says, he deserves it the most, because all the other cities have given him the honor of being seat of the Senate. Despite what Utopia means nowhere, the other names in this work are on the same line of unreality. Amor is the city of mist. It's located on the river Anidru, the river without water. The ruler Ademus is a ruler without people, and the land is inhabited by people of Akkar, people without land. In all this toponymy of nothingness, More seems to still have a certain amount of pessimism, considering it impossible for such a perfect country to exist. Utopia defines the structure of the social hierarchy, the measures of punishment, agriculture, education, mutual relation, the rules for marriage, travel, dress, death. All important social contradictions are abolished on the island. There is complete equality and freedom, and even crime and punishment disappear because there is no poverty. Social property and the organization of production, according to More, remove disorder, exploitation, misery, and deprivation. He locates the deepest source of social problems in private property. Therefore, in Utopia, there is no private property and the whole organization of production has a social character. The organization of production is planned and is performed through the general work obligation in which everyone participates and is produced exclusively to meet real needs, while the production of unnecessary luxury items that satisfy unnecessary desires are excluded. Only scientists and officials are excluded from production, who later return to their work responsibilities. The distribution of goods is done to everyone according to the needs. Through his intention in his theory of the ideal society to show the relations of true equality, More also faces the problem on how to create the same living conditions for the rural and urban population. Utopia. For the first time, he gives an idea to reduce or cancel the difference and opposition between the city and the village, and he solves it by losing the permanent rural population. In Utopia, there are no significant social differences in the position between the citizens, although there are slaves who will do the things that the Utopians should not do, and those are things that are unpleasant or difficult. This only shows that at that time the idea of a completely classless society could not be fully implemented, even theoretically. With these views, which are in complete contradiction with the social reality, he directly criticized the scholasticism with its dogmatism and sterility that make free scientific thought impossible. Only the liberation of philosophical thought from religion, which is still the most important philosophical problem, and independence from religious dogma, will enable free intellectual and cultural progress. More's notions although they originate from one spiritually hardened and dark time, and despite the prevailing anti-scholastic spirit and struggle against the Middle Ages, are thoughts from which Renaissance optimism springs, and their magnificently bold notions of their time. This is how Moore imagines the ideal society, but nevertheless the beginnings of utopian ideas, images of perfect places, and imagined ideal society can be found even before this spiritually unstable period, even in the Bible and ancient works. Most of these worlds are set outside of history and time, or in mythical times. The conflict between the ideal and the real is always present, with the idea and intention that those places once existed do exist, or that those societies are realistically possible.
Comfort us not a little, and above all, the sign of the cross to that instrument was to us a great rejoicing, and as it were a certain presage of good. Our answer was in the Spanish tongue, that for our ship it was well, for we had rather met with calms and contrary winds than any tempests. For our sick, they were many, and in very ill case, so that if they were not permitted to land, they ran danger of their lives. Our other wants we set down in particular, adding that we had some little store of merchandise which, if it pleased them to deal for, it might supply our wants, without being chargeable unto them. We offered some reward in pistolets unto the servant, and a piece of crimson velvet to be presented to the officer, but the servant took them not, nor would scarce look upon them, and so left us, and went back in another little boat which was sent for him. About 3 hours after we had dispatched our answer, there came towards us a person, as it seemed, of place. He had on him a gown with wide sleeves of a kind of water chamois, of an excellent azure color, fair more glossy than ours. His under apparel was green, and so was his hat, being in the form of a turban, daintily made, and not so huge as the Turkish turbans. And the locks of his hair came down below the brims of it. A reverend man was he to behold. He came in a boat, gilt in some part of it, with 4 persons more only in that boat, and was followed by another boat, wherein were some 20. When he was come within a flight shot of our ship, signs were made to us that we should send forth some to meet him upon the water, which we presently did in our ship boat, sending the principal man amongst us save one, and 4 of our number with him. When we were come within 6 yards of their boat, they called to us to stay, and not to approach farther, which we did. And thereupon the man whom I before described stood up, and with a loud voice in Spanish asked, "Are ye Christians?" We answered we were, fearing the less, because of the cross we had seen in the subscription. At which answer the said person lifted up his right hand towards heaven, and drew it softly to his mouth, which is the gesture they use when they thank God, and then said, "If ye will swear, all of you, by the merits of the Savior, that ye are no pirates, nor have shed blood, lawfully nor unlawfully,
seems so absurd on their face, especially when I add that I am a young man, apparently of about 30 years of age, that no person can be blamed for refusing to read another word of what promises to be a mere imposition upon his credulity. Nevertheless, I earnestly assure the reader that no imposition is intended, and will undertake, if he shall follow me a few pages, to entirely convince him of this. If I may then provisionally assume, with a pledge of justifying the assumption, that I know better than the reader when I was born, I will go on with my narrative. As every schoolboy knows, in the latter part of the 19th century, the civilization of today, or anything like it, did not exist. although the elements which were to develop it were already in ferment. Nothing had, however, occurred to modify the immemorial division of society into the four classes, or nations, as they may be more fitly called, since the differences between them were far greater than those between any nations nowadays, of the rich and the poor, the educated and the ignorant. I myself was rich and also educated, and possessed, therefore, all the elements of happiness enjoyed by the most fortunate in that age, living in luxury and occupied only with the pursuit of the pleasures and refinements of life. I derived the means of my support from the labor of others, rendering no sort of service in return. My parents and grandparents had lived in the same way, and I expected that my descendants, if I had any, would enjoy a like easy existence. But how could I live without service to the world, you ask? Why should the world have supported in utter idleness one who was able to render service? The answer is that my great-grandfather had accumulated a sum of money on which his descendants had ever since lived. The sum, you will naturally infer, must have been very large not to have been exhausted in supporting three generations in idleness. This, however, was not the fact. The sum had been originally by no means large. It was, in fact, much larger now that three generations had been supported upon it in idleness than it was at first. This mystery of use without consumption, of warmth without combustion, seems like magic, but was merely an ingenious application of the art now happily lost, but carried to great perfection by your ancestors, of shifting the burden of one's support on the shoulders of others. The man who had accomplished this, at the end of the story, was
actually on the universe's best. Се дури не создаваат речисцелосен круг со пречник околу 500 мили. Може да си го представите островот во облик на полумесечина, чии крајни точки се разделени една од друга со тесен канал во широчина од 11 мили, кој потоа се шири во едно големо езеро, кој повеќе личи на еден огромен мирен вир, во кој никогаш не се креваат големи бранови. Затоа целата внатрешност на островот практично служи како пристаниште. Бродовите може да пловат по него во сите правци, што се разбира е од голема корист за секого на островот. Влезот во пристаништето е преполно со опасни гребени и плитоци. Причеси на средината од влезот високо се издига една стрмна карпа која не представува опасност за бродовите. На незиниот врв е изградена кула во која постојано се чува стража. Но другите гребени се многу опасни, бидејќи не се гледа. Само утопијанците знаат каде се наоѓаат безбедните премини, па затоа е практично невозможно некој туѓински брод да влезе во пристаништето без вешт водич од утопија. Пловидбата е ризична дури за самите домородци, иако на брегот се поставени знаци, а во случај некој непријателски брод да се обиде да влезе во пристаништето, и лесно може да ги прераспоредат знаците и да го наведат бродот кон подводните гребени. Се разбира, постојат голем број пристаништа на другата страна од островот и секој од нив е добро утврден, дали со природни препреки или со изградени ѕидини. Затоа, доволен е само мал број бранители за успешно да ги одбранат и оддалеку по многобројна жива сила, што би се истоварила на брегот и се обидала да ги освои. Се вели дека порано утопија всушност не било остров, туку полуостров, што може впрочем да се заклучи од повнимателно проучување на неговиот облик. Полуостровот, кој порано се викала Бракса, било освоен од некој освојувач би има утопија и наречен според него. Овој освојувач успеал да ја прититоми дивата и примитивна раса, да ја превори во народ кој било живеел на островот и најцивилизираниот народ на светот. Веднаш по доаѓањето и освојувањето на земјата тој нареди да се ископа канал преку тесниот премин до околу 50 мили.
It is obvious that none of these utopian ideals have their realization further in reality, including communism, for the creation of which they must have had an ideological influence. The negation of these ideas, which are evidently more present in reality, and that would mean a representation not of a happy, ideal society, but of the realization of something opposite, a totalitarian society ruled by misfortune, is formulated in the ideas of negative utopia or anti-utopia, dystopia. The present shows not only that utopian ideals are not being realized, but that their place is unfortunately being taken by anti-utopian anticipations, which are being realized more and more rapidly and in a shorter time in the reality of society. Pessimistic constructs whose idea and then realization arise only from everyday reality. Utopian ideals, however, will continue to exist at least in the dreams of dreamers, poets, philosophers, and it seems that they will remain there in the transcendence of fantasy, and such dreams and ideas will be a frightening utopia for a long time, especially for today's pragmatic thinkers. Meanwhile, pessimistic negative utopian predictions about the future of humanity will increasingly grab with their predictive power, competing which of them will more accurately approach the future, which according to them is not so happy. But what is it that drives this development of social reality and humanity in general, a development contrary to utopian ideas, and one can they not be realized? What is society like today, and what are the projections of the negative utopia for the future? Why are these predictions almost completely realized, and can they ever be avoided?
This is Radio Utopia speaking.